Hi, everybody. I'm Donna Egan. I'm an alcoholic. It's really a pleasure to be here. It's been so much fun to be down here, and it's just been such a thrill to me to meet all these wonderful people and these beautiful women in recovery that I've never met before, and a chance to just be a part of. And this is such a wonderful roundup, and I'm just really happy to be here. I want to thank the committee for inviting me to come down here, and I just can't tell you. I wish I could right now. I could think of all the little details of everything everybody's done to make me feel welcome and indulge my California ways, but they really have, you know. In fact, today when Julie was driving us around, we had her saying "you guys," and she kept saying, "This isn't right. You're supposed to be saying y'all by now." So, anyway, let me see. It's an honor and a privilege for me to be asked to participate in any way in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm extremely grateful for any opportunity to do anything. And I am someone who believes that I will never live long enough to, even in any small way, repay this program for what I've been given. And, for anybody that's new here tonight, I just want to say, you know, I'm no authority on Alcoholics Anonymous, and there isn't anybody I've met yet that speaks from the podium or does any job in AA that is any kind of an authority or, you know, has anything that anybody else doesn't have except an opportunity to do this, you know, and I'm really grateful for that opportunity. And I liked what Tom shared last night about never feeling qualified to do any particular job that he happens to be doing in AA, and that's definitely the way I feel. I just know that a sober alcoholic, you know, the way I live today as a sober woman, I have a lot more chance to, to be a little more, to be able to give a little bit more. And I essentially just want to express my gratitude for this opportunity. I am I'm not a speaker who does this very often, as you can tell, and I'm probably not a speaker that wants to do this very often, as a matter of fact. But I really try to be gracious to this program because it's given me everything I have, and so that's the reason I'm here tonight. And we have a little bit of time to kill, so I'm just going to get on with it. I'll take my watch off in keeping with the tradition that was started last night to present an illusion of hopefulness that I might remain aware at what kind of time is being passed here, anything at all. I want to tell you I'm real comfortable in Edisto. I'll tell you just a little bit about what it used to be like for me, what happened, and what it's like now, and that's what is suggested that we do. And I grew up in Montana. I'm the oldest of four kids. My mother was 14 years old when she married my dad, and he was 17, and they did so to escape alcoholic homes, you know. And my mom and dad got married at that young age, and they ran away, and they wanted more than anything in the world to have a life that was different than the life that they came from. And I really know that that's true. My parents are very young today, and because I'm very young, as you can tell, no. It's really true. I know that was their intention, and that was their desire, and they probably did everything they could to make that happen. You know, the difficulty with that is my dad was an alcoholic. My dad was an alcoholic who didn't drink for quite a while. But he carried all of the characteristics of this disease, and he was an alcoholic waiting for a drink. And the reason I tell that story is just because that's a little bit of the background. It's also identical to my story. I was an alcoholic who didn't drink for the first part of my life, too. I was the oldest of four kids, and we lived in Billings, Montana. And my dad was a builder. He built houses for a living, and we moved a lot. We moved about every 3 months. And we moved 27 times in one 10-year period and never left town. So, I mean, we were moving. And I grew up in this family. I was considerably older than my sisters and brothers. And, we lived in a household that was governed by the rules of alcoholism, even though my dad didn't drink for quite a little while. He didn't start drinking until I was probably in my early teens. And but he was full of all of the anger and all the rage and all the shame and all of the self-loathing that I am very familiar with. And those were the kind of things that were going on in our home. And I'm a person who grew up in a household that was full of all of the garden variety types of abuse that go on in alcoholic households. All the types of stuff that you hear about. People talk about it real easily today, and it's just nothing to hear about those things being recounted, but You know, I tell you that in the late 1960s in Billings, Montana, you didn't talk about those things. I mean, those were things that just were not discussed. And from the outside, our family looked really good. We lived in brand new houses, and my dad was successful. And we had these, you know, four little kids, and my job was to essentially raise those kids. But inside that home, it was all of the terror and fear and, you know, anxiety that you live with as an alcoholic. And I tell that. I've been encouraged to tell that, and essentially, truthfully, it has absolutely nothing to do with why I'm an alcoholic. I am an alcoholic because I have the disease of alcoholism, and it has nothing to do with my parents at all. They didn't do that to me, and they didn't. It has nothing to do with the way I was raised or anything else. I am a person who is who's allergic to alcohol, and I have a physical allergy coupled with a mental obsession, and I'm an alcoholic all by myself. I was an alcoholic. Probably it's my belief that it was from the day I was born. You know, I was just that's the way it was for me. But I tell that because it's important that if anybody has ever had those similar experiences and you're new and you think you know, that you have a lot of things you have to deal with as a result of the past or whatever, and it gets real foggy trying to deal with how do we begin to recover as alcoholics with all of this other baggage. And I just say that because, first of all, if I can recover, then you can recover, you know, and that gives a little bit of hope. And the other thing is that I can honestly tell you that coming into Alcoholics Anonymous and being very slowly and very patiently taught about the principles of this program and being taught in a very loving way how to begin to practice these steps on my life, I have received, you know, an incredible amount of change within me that I never would have, you know, a healing in areas that probably never would have happened otherwise. This program has done more for me than just deal with my alcoholism. You know, it's given me a chance to be a pretty happy person today, and it's given me a complete new perspective on the way I grew up. And I can tell you that I hold no malice toward my parents today. I don't blame them for anything. Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me how to pay more attention to what kind of a daughter I am than what kind of parents they were. And it's also taught me, I remember being told real early that when I could accept another human being for who and what they were, then I would have the freedom to be who and what I am. And I remember when I heard that I had no idea what it meant, but I really liked the sound of it. And that's the truth today. You know, the truth today is I try to be as loving and as courteous to my parents as I can be, and I don't blame them. My mom and dad did the best that they could. They may have done a really rotten job, but they did the best that they could. And I did the best that I could as an alcoholic mother. I did a really rotten job in a lot of areas, but I did the best that I could. And thanks to the principles of this program, I've been able to focus on how I live my life today, one day at a time. And you know, that's important for me to share. I can tell you, just to encapsulate things a little bit, there was lots of things going on in our home that were just huge secrets. And when I was 17, my dad got caught for some of the things that were going on in our home, and it was sort of a really surprise deal, and he was afraid he was going to go to jail. And we ended up leaving town in the middle of the night in February and moving to Northern California. And we just did this huge geographic, and I was a junior in high school, and they just decided that I wasn't going to go back to school. I was going to go to work because they didn't want anybody else to find out about what was going on, you know. And so at 17 years old, the reason that this was such a tough, you know, deal for me was that at 17 years old, I'd never been to a dance or a football game or on a date. I had never done any of the things that the rest of the people that I knew did. And the reason that's significant to me is because those were a lot of the reasons why I felt like I was different than a lot of people. I didn't have those things. You know, I didn't have those memories. And those. I used to make a lot of things up. I'd make a lot of things up about the way things were at home because you didn't talk about the way things really were. And so I just had a lot of secrets. And I had a lot of lies that I allowed myself to believe in. And, you know, essentially what happened for me was that I bounced around a little bit from the time I was 17 till I was 19. I lived with my mom and dad a little bit. I lived with an aunt. I lived with my grandmother a little bit. When I was 19, I met a man, and I married him, and I had 5 kids in 6 years and 3 months. And so I was really busy. And and I'll tell you exactly what I wanted more than anything in the world. I wanted to go somewhere and make a life for me and for my family that was not like the life that I had come from. I wanted the exact thing that my mom and dad wanted. And their goals and their dreams were the same as mine. And I think that's, you know, realizing that in AA has allowed me to really get a perspective on the way things have been, to not feel so bad about it. I had absolutely no idea. There was a lot. I had, you know, I'm one of those people that talk about in the big book. I had grave emotional and mental disorders. I was an extremely freaked out woman with a real lot of responsibility, you know, and no idea whatsoever about how to deal with that responsibility. I have a little story that I have to tell. It is my little snapshot. This is like my little, this is a glimpse into what I had going for me. My goal was to be, you know, a good mom and a good wife, but I really had no idea how to do that. And I was doing the best that I could. I kind of, what I wanted to do was take sort of like what I saw my mom and dad do, except leave out the stuff that I knew was not a good idea, and just go with that, you know. But the truth is I had no idea how to begin to do that. And this little story that I like to tell is just a perfect little example of the deal. And it's that when I was growing up, we lived out in the country, and my mom used to get her eggs from the guy that lived down the road. And he had a bunch of chickens, and what she would do is save the egg cartons, and when the egg cartons were empty, she'd stick them up on top of the refrigerator. And when they were, you know, she had enough, she'd go down the road and buy the eggs, and guy'd fill them up, and, you know, you get the idea. Well, I married this man at the age of 19, and he was in the Navy, and he was stationed in Charleston, South Carolina. And I was living in Charleston, and I'd been married about 6 months, and I had this big old stack of egg cartons on top of the refrigerator. And one day he said to me, "What are you saving these for?" And I just, I'll never forget it. I just said, "Hey, I don't know." "I don't know. That's where they go. That's what you do with them." And that's, you know, it never occurred to me to question why my parents did what they did. Or like, was it working for them? Or like, did I know anybody that had any chickens? I didn't know. Anyway. When I got to the house I'm staying at here in Edisto, there's this giant stack of egg cartons on top of the refrigerator that these girls all put up there so that I would feel at home. I had my picture taken by the egg cartons many times this weekend. Anyway, I truly did, you know, everything I could do in that marriage. I wanted more than anything to be a good wife and a good mother, but I was a very, very freaked out person. I had a lot of emotional disorders. I had a lot of serious problems, and I had a very little, you know, just a tremendous amount of fear. And what ended up happening for me was about every 6 months I was on the phone to suicide prevention. I mean, I was extremely suicidal. I was very self-destructive. I was very overwhelmed with all the responsibility that I had, and I had no idea what to do with these kids. I mean, I would dress them and feed them and kind of like stack them up, you know. I didn't know what to do with them. And I wanted to be able to do it, but I didn't know how. When my youngest child was 9 months old, my oldest was 6 years old, and my youngest was 9 months old, my husband had an affair. And so I threw him out, and I took the kids. Big mistake. Big mistake. But I took the kids, and I just decided, you know, we're going to go do this ourselves. And it was then, I was 26 years old, almost 27, I went to work in the bar. And up until that time, I had only been exposed to alcohol a couple of times. And the same thing always happened to me when I picked up a drink. I would get violently sick and extremely depressed. So it was not a lot of fun to be around. And it was not pleasant memories, you know, that I had of alcohol. But when I went to work in the bar at 26, 27 years old, and I had these five kids, and I started using alcohol, I remember very clearly that within the first, you know, short time, within the first year, I suppose, that I started drinking, what I found was a power greater than myself that solved my problem. And it was something I'd been looking for my whole life. It made my life work for me. And I'd never been able to find anything that worked for me. All of the times that I tried, you know, suicide prevention and counselors and therapists and religion and God, and I mean, I tried everything I could think of. But when I found alcohol, what it did for me was something that nothing else would do. When I had alcohol in me, I didn't have to be that scared little kid from Billings, Montana that didn't know what you knew. I didn't have to be that person who had no history and no resources. You know, I didn't have to be the one who never went to the senior prom or any of that stuff. You know, it made me okay. I don't know that it made me really feel as good as you, but it made me not care. It made me not care what my background was, you know. And the fear was the biggest thing that I needed the escape from. And I just, you know, I had a whirlwind romance with alcohol. And I turned my life and my will over to alcohol, and it called the shots for me. And through my drinking, I can tell you that by the time I started drinking, I had moved to Billings. I was living in Red Lodge, which is a little ski resort town about 65 miles southwest of Billings. And it's right at the foot of the Beartooth Mountains. It's a beautiful little place. It's about maybe 12,000 people live there. It's just a tiny little, you know, extremely insane party town. I mean, I drank in the bars, the cowboy bars that had signs on the wall that said, please check your guns with the bartender. I mean, it was like really, really wild. My goal for the night was, I used to say this every time I'd go out, I'd say, I'm going to get so high tonight I could go duck hunting with a rake. And in Montana, they know what that means, you know. And you probably know what that means down here, too. In California, they don't know what I'm talking about. But anyway. It was just, I don't know, I suppose I had a lot of fun. It seemed to be pretty wild and crazy. Essentially, it was escape for me, you know, and it wasn't very pretty, and it didn't last very long, and I was out of control. I was a blackout drinker. I, you know, hated worse than anything in the world waking up in the morning and hearing those terrible words, don't you remember what you did last night? You know, it was never good news. It was never a nice report. And but, you know, I was willing to do that. It was the only thing I knew that would take the fear away. And I drank, you know, at the end, I probably got away with it maybe for the first couple of years, but towards the end, it was horrible. It was really horrible. I drank so many times when I didn't want to drink, and I drank so many times when I knew what it was doing to me and what it was doing to my kids. You know, those were really frightening times, and I didn't, you know, that was not my goal. I didn't want to become a piece of human garbage, and that's what I did. When I put alcohol in me, I lost it all. I hit Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time in February of 1981. I came into, it was bad. I'd been trying to quit drinking already for a couple of years on my own, and I never could do it. somebody told me about AA. This guy that, in fact, one of my lower companions. I was living with a guy that was a drummer in a country rock band, you know. And one day he said to me, man, you have got to do something about your drinking. I mean, he said, why don't you go to AA? And I was really insulted that he would say that to me. I mean, this guy was not exactly your pillar of the community kind of guy. And, you know, and he's telling me I need to do something about my drinking, but he was right. And I'd never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never heard of it. I come from a family, long, long history of alcoholism. My grandfather and three of my uncles committed suicide behind their alcoholism. Everybody I knew, my dad was a terrible alcoholic, and he used to play with guns a lot and be very suicidal, and, you know, and I was suicidal. I mean, all I knew was that you drank until you couldn't stand it anymore, and then you just found whatever way out you had to find. And I went to AA. I did not know what to find. I mean, I didn't know what to expect when I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. I sure didn't expect to find people who were not drinking. I expected to find people who were trying not to drink, because that's what I was doing. I was kind of trying not to drink, and I expected to find a bunch of miserable people just like me. It really blew me away when I went in there and people talked about having some years of sobriety behind them. That was like, you know, you got to be kidding. And I can tell you that the people in Red Lodge were very kind to me. They were very, very kind to me, very patient with me, and they tried to help me. I just wasn't done. You know, I was really not done. My big problem, I thought, when I came into AA, I thought that my problem was alcohol. I thought that the insanity that in the places that it took me and the people that I had to be with was what was wrong with my life. And, you know, very slowly over a number of years, what I found out was that sobriety is really my problem. You know, when I don't have anything to buffer between me and what's going on in my life, it's just terrifying. And Maryam and I have been talking a lot about that. You know, she thinks that that she has fear and I don't have fear, you know. And Tom was talking about that last night, walking through this little curtain of fear. You know, there isn't anything I do that I'm not afraid of doing. I do it because this is what I was taught. And I do it because I found out that I can walk through this fear and it doesn't kill me, you know. And sometimes I do well and sometimes I don't do so well, but it doesn't make any difference. I made it through the fear. And that's what counts. That's what makes me, you know, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I'm willing to do that. And, you know, if that fear was the thing that kept me running back to alcohol for a long time. I didn't want to be who I was. I didn't like anything about me, and I didn't like where I'd come from. And when I didn't have alcohol, I had to face that. And that was really tough. So I bounced in and out of AA for 7 years. And if you are new and this is your first go-around, I want you to know that you don't have to do that. You know, relapse is not a part of this program, and it is not necessary for you to go back out there and do that again. If you're new and this is not your first go-around, I want to tell you that, you know, it can happen. It can happen for you. Just keep coming back, you know, keep coming back, essentially. And I've heard people that complain about that. So I heard somebody say, oh, I just hate it when I hear people say keep coming back, because that gives you the impression that it's just okay to go back out there again. And it's not. There's a lot of people who don't make it back. I was just one of the really, really lucky ones. This is not a revolving door, you know. I owe my life to this program, and I am willing to give everything. I'm willing to put it all up there. But it was a long time before I was able to do that. I lost my children as a result of my drinking and using. When I first hit AA in February of 81, I still had my kids. I still had a job. I had a car. It was a 67 Falcon with a bumper sticker on the back that said, thank you for not laughing at my car. But, hey, it was a car, right? And I had a boyfriend. I had this relationship. And, you know, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous the last time, the 5th of May, 1987, every single one of those things was gone and more. And all the things that they kept talking about, all the yets that hadn't happened to me had begun to happen. And I was really beaten. I hit AA the last time. I had become like kind of an enforced periodic. You know, I could stomach sobriety just so long, and then I would get drunk, and then I would have to go through all of that horrible trying to clean up one more time. You know, I probably had to raise my hand as a newcomer and a member in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous probably 30 times over that 7 years, and it was hell. It was hell. It was worse than drinking. You know. I didn't want to drink. I wanted to have a life. And I wanted my kids back. And that was why I came back so many times. When I came in the last time, I had lost all my hope. And I didn't believe for 1 minute that this was going to work for me, because in my opinion, it never had. And I was just stringing as many days together as I could get. That was all. And it just turns out that it was my last drink. It wasn't my worst drunk. There wasn't anything significant that happened in that time. It was just that it was the last. And I came into AA not believing that I was going to be sober. I mean, I didn't. I know that a lot of times I came in here and said, man, we're going to do this, you know. You're going to get tough here, and you're going to do what they tell you to do, and we're going to make it happen. And when I came in the last time, I didn't think it was going to work for me. I had no hope that it would work for me, but I had nowhere else to go, and I was one very, very angry woman. And I was going to meetings in Kona. I had done a geographic, and I was living over in Kona, Hawaii. When I went over to Kona, I got about almost a year and a half over there. That was my longest period of sobriety. The rest of all my times were about 30 days. And when I got drunk that last time, I thought, that's it. I don't know what in the world to do, you know. And I remember sitting in a meeting, and all the times before I had been in AA, I really tried to, you know, I watched what you did, and I tried to do what I saw you do. I tried to imitate you. I was, you know, probably one of my only coping skills was being a chameleon. You know, I mean, I was just trying to blend in. That's it. That's a big mistake. That's a big mistake around here. It was a big mistake for me. I just watched what people did, and I watched how they dressed, and I watched how they acted, and I tried to imitate that, you know. I didn't know why. I was just saving egg cartons, just trying to get through. That's all, you know. And but I had really hit the end of a rope. And I remember being in a meeting, and there was a guy in there that night, and I had listened to the whole thing. And at the end of the meeting, he said, does anybody in here have a burning desire? And I just said, yeah, I got a burning desire. And I said, you know, I'm so sick and tired of listening to you people tell me about how sober is better. Sober does not feel better to me. Sober feels terrible. And I said, I'm just, you know, I'm angry, and I'm frustrated, and I'm so pissed at you. And I was angry at anybody that had a relationship or sobriety, either one. It seemed to me like in Kona, you know, especially in Kona, they say it's for the newlyweds and the nearly deads, you know, but everybody's with somebody, you know, and I was alone and angry. And I know after, I don't even remember what I said. That was probably essentially it. And when I finished, everybody just went, all right, Donna, you know, keep coming back, honey. That's good. I thought, geez. You guys are really sick. You are really sick. And I was just so angry, you know. It was only a couple of days after that. The Big Book talks about, you know, it's so very important. It talks about an essential psychic change. There's a lot of different ways to put it. It talks about a moment of clarity, or it talks about a spiritual experience. There's a lot of different terms that are used for that, but that happened for me. And, you know, I want to tell you that if you're new and that hasn't happened for you, don't worry about it. You just stay here and it'll happen, you know. But it also says in the Big Book that that no permanent effect is had until some sort of a psychic change happens. And I can tell you what mine was. And it's not a huge deal, and it probably won't mean anything to you, but it means real lot to me, and I remember it very, very clearly. I was just sort of struggling along, you know. I was doing this sobriety stuff, you know. How you doing? Fine. Why? You know, I was not happy, joyous, and free. And I was really angry and really frustrated, but I had nowhere else to go. And I was working for a guy that was doing hand-painted T-shirts. I mean, this was not a really heavy-duty job, but it was the only job I had. And I had this little apartment. I living in this little Roach Motel place in Kona that I had 9 days left on the rent before the rent was due, and I had almost no money. But I had this stupid little job, and I had this creepy little boss, and I had this lousy sobriety, you know, and life was not panning out to my expectations. And I got up and went to work one morning, and this boss just said something to me, and I just told him he could just take his job and shove it, you know. And I walked away from that job knowing, you dummy. I mean, you have just blown your only chance of paying your rent. Now you're going to be on the street. I'd been there before. I didn't like it, and I was not happy about going back. And I was walking down the street in Kona. I was a block from my apartment, and I looked up at the apartment building, and the knowledge went through me, like, I mean, just a knowledge went through me that if I walked into that place, I was going to kill myself. And I absolutely knew beyond a doubt that I could do it. I mean, I'd made some attempts before, but there was just something about that moment. I saw my life. My spiritual awakenings have always been in the same form. I think it's funny because it's happened in sobriety, too. And this is the message I always get. You are going to die, and there's nothing you can do about it. That's it. That's when I know. That's what God says to me. You are without hope, and it is over. You are not going to pull it out one more time. And that happened to me, and it scared me to death. As much as I thought I didn't care about living or dying, and as much as I, you know, had always thought that if it ever gets too bad, I'll just bail, there was just something about that knowledge that scared me to death. And I stopped at a phone booth, and I started to call some AA phone numbers of these stupid little women that kept giving me their stupid little phone numbers, you know, that I never would call. And you know this thing about if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, to me that always sounded like, you know, if you're ready, if you will, you know, walk naked across broken glass or, you know, whatever. I mean, huge lengths. But I really think that for me, it is being willing to go to any length at all. If I will do one thing, just reach out in one way, you know, and Alcoholics Anonymous was there. I started in the A's, and I wasn't being very picky that day, and I was calling anybody I could find, and I called three or four places before I got somebody, and this woman came and picked me up right away, and she spent a little bit of time with me, and we went to a meeting that evening, and, you know, it wasn't a huge deal. What was a huge deal was the very first time I'd ever reached out, and it was the very first time I'd ever admitted that I was defeated, and I was lost, and I was scared. And I asked for help. I called this woman, and she answered the phone, and I said, I'm going to die. And she said, what are you talking about? I said, I'm going to die. I'm going to kill myself. And she said, I'll be right there. And, you know, what happened for me is a couple of days after that, a woman came to Kona that carried the AA message to me. And she was the first person. I mean, there's no way that I could stand here and tell you that nobody had given me the AA message. I am quite sure that in 7 years I probably heard it 1,000 times. But for some reason, when this woman came to town, I heard her. I heard her, and I could feel her love, and I could feel her concern. This woman's name was Phyllis Cowman, and she died about 8 years ago, and she was my Eskimo. I mean, she was an incredible woman. This lady loved Alcoholics Anonymous, and she loved being sober, and she loved drunks. And she didn't care if you were drunk or sober. She did not care. And she had a real... she had a real gift of being able to just zero in on the sickest woman in the room and just, like, you know, move right in. And she just, honed right in on me, you know. And she came up to me. I remember her putting her arm around me, and I remember her saying, "Honey, it's going to be okay. You just stay by me. Everything's going to be all right." And she said to me, "If I had a daughter, she'd be just like you. She'd be real sick." And I was really honored. I thought, you know, cool. She likes me, you know. Anyway, I just adored her. She was a wonderful woman. And I only got to spend about a month with her. She was only in Kona for about a month. But this woman, we spent many, many hours on the beach. And what happened with Phyllis was that she shared with me about her history. She told me about some of the secrets in her family. And she told me about some of the shame that she had. And she was also estranged from her kids. And she told me about her history drinking, and she told me about her sobriety. And she shared her life with me. She just kind of laid it out there, you know. And it was in a way that I could hear her. I could hear what she was saying. I remember being on the beach with her one day and saying, well, you know, I probably need to do like another 4-step. You know, I thought that would be a good place to start. And she said, "No, honey, you just need to do a 1st step. And I said, "Well, I don't know what you mean, really, because, you know, I mean, I know I'm an alcoholic. I am. Like, how can I say I'm not an alcoholic?" And she said that the first step in Alcoholics Anonymous is that we are powerless and that our lives are unmanageable. And she said, "That implies action." She said, "That means you need to look for a new manager." She said, "You need new management. You need a sponsor and you need a higher power." And then she said, "Well, tell me about your higher power. Who have you got for a higher power?" And so I told her about, you know, some of the churches I had attended and some of the philosophies that I had, you know, studied. And she said, "Wait a minute." She said, "I want to tell you something. Any God that you can understand is going to be too small for your needs." And I thought, boy, she lost me there. I didn't know what she meant, you know. And she said, let me put it to you like this. This is just a suggestion. She said, "Every night when you lay down and go to sleep, your lungs inflate and deflate all night long, and your heart beats all night long. And there isn't anything that you do that's going to ensure that happens for you throughout the night." And I said, "Yeah." And she said, when it comes right down to it, there's nothing you can do that will add one more minute to your time on this earth. And I thought, yeah, that's true. And she said, "Well, that is a power greater than yourself." And she said, "If you wake up in the morning and you're breathing, you are a spiritual being." And she said, "God loves you as if you were his only child." And she said, "What you need to do is direct yourself to him." And I said, "Well, you know, don't I need to know, like, who God is, or, you know, who it is I'm praying to? I mean, is it Buddha or Jesus or the great white buffalo, or what's it going to be, you know?" She said, "No, it's none of your business who God is." She said, "God knows who he is. If you talk to him, he'll answer you." I mean, she just made it so clear and so simple. And I said, "Well, you know, what do I call him?" And she said, "You call him God, you know." And I said, "You know, well, I'd probably tried this before, and I'd walked away from God." And she said, "No, you can't lose this any more than you can lose gravity." She said, "If the day ever comes that you wake up and you're not breathing, you don't have to worry about it. You're not going to be here anyway. You'll be with your higher power, you know." And so in the beginning, a very little bit, you know, just for a little bit, I thought, well, I can do that. And she said, "Look, I'm not asking you to decide or not decide on any of these philosophies. I'm not telling you what religion you should investigate, if any. But I'm just asking you to set all that stuff aside for now, and you just go to God, and you just say something to him, and you see what happens." And she said, I want you to do this thing for me." She said, "When you get alone tonight, I want you to get on your knees and put this in your own words. Say it however you want to say it, but essentially what you are going to say is something like this. You want to say, 'God, I don't know who you are, and I don't know what you want from me. But if you want anything to do with what's left of my life, then come on, because I don't know where to go from here.'" And I know that when she told me about that prayer, I knew that I could say that. I knew that that was the most honest, straight-up thing I could say. There was no question. There was no con. There was no manipulation. There was no bargain. There's no, "If you do this for me, I'll do this for you." It was straight up. I didn't know who God was, and I didn't know what he wanted. And I also knew that I had no hope on my own. And so that's what I did. And that was the beginning for me. You know, I was real interested in being rebellious. I was real angry at people in Alcoholics Anonymous for their continued sobriety, you know. Because I thought, you guys have the secret and you're not telling me. And I'm the local joke here. And so in the meetings, I would go back into the meetings with my newfound higher power and make everybody listen about it. And I always said that my new higher power was my breath, because that was what was there. And I also said that when I open my mouth and I inhale to pray, I feel the air on my tongue. And that's where my higher power lives. I said, I never did very, very good praying to a God that was out there somewhere, you know, out in the heavens, that may or may not help me if I was good enough or right enough or if I did it right or did it right long enough or anything else. But Phyllis helped me to direct this within. And it's real interesting. It was about a month ago I heard a speaker in Palm Springs who talked about the word spiritual being derived from a Latin word. 2 seconds ago, I could have told you what that was. But at any rate, what it means is breath. That's what it means, is breath of life. It's like espiritus or something like that. It means the breath of life. And that's pretty interesting to me. I think that's pretty cool. I mean, even now, and after all this time, I'm fine. You know, Phyllis directed me in a way that I was able, a path that I was able to begin. And that was a beginning. It was a clear beginning. And I did what she asked me to do. I would have done whatever she asked me to do, you know. There's no way that she could have given me in 30 days that we were together everything I was going to need to, you know, do a sober life. But she sure gave me a good beginning. She gave me a good foundation. And I go back to a lot of the things that she has shared, that she shared with me then. She died when I was about 10 months sober, I think, in my first year. And we wrote a lot and talked with each other on the phone. She was very, very sick. And, you know, I just will be forever grateful for that bit of information. And I've had other women that have come into my life in Alcoholics Anonymous who have reached out to me. And it's funny, the women who have really impacted my life have been the same as Phyllis was. She didn't tell me how to live my life, and she didn't tell me how to make decisions or what I should do or shouldn't do, but she put out her experience, and she told me about hers, and she allowed me the dignity to find it on my own. And, you know, directed me into the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is where I found this program. And I'm just so grateful. You know, I can tell you that my life in sobriety, I mean, it changed from that very beginning. I mean, right then, things changed. I was on a different footing. And I honestly didn't have a lot of hopefulness. I was not a real optimistic person. I've never been. I've always been a little bit malcontent, you know, and always waiting for the second shoe to drop and all that stuff. But I did have a different footing, and I knew that things were never going to be the same for me again. I didn't know if they were going to be better or worse, but I knew that they weren't going to be the same. And it hasn't been. It was about a year and a half after I got sober, I married a man in AA. I met a man in an AA meeting, a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and when I met him and thought, you know, I wanted to be with this guy, we'd been going out and I have to tell you that my motives in that relationship were not good. You know, I know what I thought. I was new one more time. And I remember thinking, man, if I stay with this guy, I can stay sober, you know, which is a completely wrong reason to do a relationship. But what's happened for us has been Alcoholics Anonymous. My husband has not, you know, allowed me to lean on him. He had some considerable sobriety behind him. And AA has kind of raised me in the meantime. You know, a lot of times we are both very independent people and we spend a lot of time together, but a lot of time apart. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me everything. I know that I came in and got sober and did sobriety in the beginning with one main focus in mind, and that was to get my kids back. I wanted more than anything in the world to have an opportunity as a sober woman to give something to those kids, because I had never been able to do that as a drunk. And that was a condition that I had on my sobriety. And it's just really important for me to share this because it's been a huge learning experience for me, and it's been a kind of a process that I've gone through that's allowed me to learn, you know, a little bit more about what this program is about, and that it really is a gift. That it really, really is a gift, and it doesn't depend on my behavior. It depends on my persistence, but it doesn't really depend on. I don't earn this, you know. My whole directive was to get my kids back, and I spent a lot of time and effort trying to make that happen, and all of my results were nil. I mean, I got nowhere. And in fact, in sobriety, the harder I tried, the less I got. They lived with their dad, and he was real angry and real bitter, and it just got worse. Everything I tried to build with those kids just kind of fell apart. And there was a time for 5 years that I didn't see or hear from or speak to or have any communication with my only son or my oldest daughter. And that was very painful. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, the women told me, if you stay sober and you work on you, if the day ever comes that those kids want to know you, you'll be able to walk through that situation. You'll be able to meet them and present yourself as a sober woman, and you'll be able to you'll be able to meet that situation. And if the day never comes that they want to know you, you'll be sober. But if you don't stay sober and they ever want to know you, you will have blown one more chance, and it will probably be your last. And they also told me, I would worry so much about how much I was missing, because I missed so many things in their lives. And they told me that my kids were going to be adults longer than they were going to be children, and that if I waited and took care of my job in Alcoholics Anonymous and just worked on myself and maintained my sobriety and kept this as a priority in my life, that the day would come that they'd come back to me. And what happened for me was that after 5 years of not hearing, I did begin to have small amounts of communication with a couple of the other kids. They would write, and I'd write them, and I made arrangements a couple of times to go up and see them, but always I'd go right to the town right where they were, and I wasn't able to see these two kids of mine. And after about 5 years of that, most of you guys probably remember Polly P. that spoke here at this meeting a couple of years ago. She and I have some very paralleled experiences as far as our kids go. And some of the problems that my kids had were very similar to some that she had. And I went to her one day after I heard her speak, and I told her about this situation with my kids, and I told her that I was getting ready to go to Montana on a visit and that I hadn't heard from them in so long. And she told me that I should write to them, that I should contact them. And I'm so grateful that she did. I had the opportunity yesterday to tell her what a gift she had given me. I did write to those kids, and I got a letter back, and I went up to Montana, and I was able to meet them. And I hadn't seen my son or my daughter in, 5 years. And my son, the last time I saw him, he'd been like 12 years old. And now he was like, 18 years old. And he was this tall, beautiful, blonde kid, and just funny and amazing and talented. And he was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous when I went up there. And it was incredible for me. It was absolutely incredible. I had to make that trip alone. And it was scary. I was scared to death. And I went up there and met those kids and just presented myself as a sober woman like I'd been taught to do here. And, I was able to spend so much time with him and make amends to him and say things that were important between us. We both were able to really, really mend a situation. And I will be forever grateful for that for the rest of my life. It was shortly after I left up there that my son started drinking again. And he drank for a few months. And then a year ago in January, he committed suicide. And he was a member of AA that was not able to find what I found here. He was not able to find a power greater than himself to solve his problem. And, there's a couple of phases of this that I really want to share with you. And one is that last summer when I went up to Billings, my former mother-in-law gave me some of Daniel's belongings. And in the belongings were a list of things, of instructions that he got from his sponsor. And this man who tried to help him, gave him what he had to give. But there wasn't anything about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous on these pages. There was a lot of good advice. There was a huge 2 pages of lists, and there were things like, you will get up at 6:30 in the morning, you will jog, you will drink water, lots of water, for 30 days, and you will eat 3 meals a day for 30 days. He wanted him to open a savings account and give the passbook to his grandmother. He wanted to make sure that his teachers at school had his grandmother's phone number. I mean, there were a lot of things that were like, perfectly wonderful advice, but it was not the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was nothing about presenting himself to a power greater than himself. It was nothing about asking God for help. There was a lot of direction. And it's my belief that, my son did what he could do. He did it for 90 days. And I don't know about you, but I am an alcoholic, and I get real bored with good behavior. I can only do that just so long. And then, the good behavior feels really good, but it's just not rewarding enough to keep me going, and it wasn't rewarding enough to keep him going. And I know that at the end of a couple of months of drinking, I know this for a fact, I know that he thought, I cannot go on living the way I'm living, and I can't go back to AA because I did what they told me to do, and it didn't work. And when I came away from that, I have those pages, And I really want to tell you tonight that I have no anger or malice toward anybody in AA. But what I came away with me was, man, I want to be really sure that what I tell women that I help comes right out of that big book. Main reason is this program guarantees specific results. And the theme of this conference has been the promises. And those are some of the things that are guaranteed to me. If I will do these things will happen. And there's very little that you can guarantee with anything else. And I came back and I started again in the big book. I started in again, being a student of this program. And, you know, I have made the same mistake. I've gone through sponsoring women, given them a lot of really good advice on what they ought to do, what they shouldn't do, and what, you know, they ought to do with their jobs or their marriages or their kids or anything else. And that's none of my business. You know, the only thing that... The only thing that I have to offer is this program. And the fellowship is something aside from that. And I remember a guy that I heard from Chicago who just made this huge point that made so much difference to me. He said it's like this. He said that the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the meetings and the friendships that you make, that's like the hospital. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the big book and the steps and the higher power, that's like the surgery. And he said, it doesn't make any difference how much time you spend at the hospital or how nice they are to you when you're there or how good you feel when you've been there. If you don't have the operation, you're going to die from the disease. And it made a huge impact on me. That's why I was unsuccessful around here for so many years. You know, if just sitting in an AA meeting would have done it, I sat in hundreds of AA meetings, and it didn't give me what I needed. What I need is a spiritual answer. I have a spiritual malady, and there's only one thing that will fix it. And, you know, that's some of what I learned from this experience this last year. And the other part I just want to share with you briefly is what it has been like for me to walk through this as a sober woman. I have been as confused and as lost and afraid as I've ever been in my entire life. I felt a few months into this that I really lost any connection that I had with a higher power. I didn't know what to do or where to turn. There were a lot of things that I thought I believed in that I started to question. It was my training in Alcoholics Anonymous that really saved my butt. And what I was taught here is that you put your butt in the chair and you stay until the meeting is over. And I did that. I went. I just showed up. And I didn't know what else to do. It wasn't because I wanted to be a good AA member. Believe me, I wanted to run. And there were some things that I heard that was a lot of good advice. There were some things that I heard that were not good. I can't blame. I can't criticize or judge what happens here. All I know is I have to be here. This is the only way for me. And, you know, what happened for me is one more time, I hit that point of surrender. One more time, I hit the wall with this. I did everything I knew how to do to keep myself going. I was going to meetings. I had my jobs in AA. I was doing all the things I've been taught how to do, and I was dying. I just felt like I was dying. And I just hit a wall with it, you know, and God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. I mean, I hit a point where at the end of almost a year, I went to bed one day, and I quit AA, and I quit my job, and I quit my marriage, and I quit my life. I just quit. I didn't know what to do. And I laid there, and I cried, and I begged God for help. I said, you have got to do something. And you know what I found out? I laid there for 2 days. I had a lot of conditions on my sobriety. I had a lot of preconceived notions about what sober life is supposed to be for me. You know, I mean, we hear that. We hear, like, sober is better, and what I thought that meant is that bad things wouldn't happen. You know, and now that bad things are happening, what the hell do I do with this? You know, I'm not happy, joyous, and free. What's wrong? And, you know, I had people, and they meant really well. They told me that the reason I was having trouble dealing with my son's death was because I hadn't done a good enough third step. You know, and I'm not blaming anybody. I'm just saying that what happened for me was that I had to really dig deep for God. I had to really turn again to a power greater than myself that would solve my problem. And I remember hitting that point. And at the end of a couple of days, I got out this box that's my God box. It's where I put all my special stuff, you know. And I had all those letters that I had from my son. I had the instructions that he got from his sponsor. I had every loving card and letter I've ever gotten from anybody in AA. I had real special things in there. And I just, one by one, I read a lot of obituaries of sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, people who had died sober. I mean, there was just a whole bunch of memories. And I just spread all this stuff out and looked at it all. And I remember hitting a point where I just said, God, you know what? I will live any way you want me to live. I will do anything you want me to do. I don't care where I work. I don't care where I live. I don't care who comes or who goes. You have just got to give me some peace. And if you will just give me some peace and help me stay sober, I'll do anything you want me to do. And it was really amazing because that's exactly what happened. You know, I mean, I just stopped fighting. I just gave up. And Phyllis always said that the key to this program is surrender. And she had a lovely little tradition that I've started up again. She used to make these little white flags out of toothpicks and little pieces of paper. And she had bagfuls of them, and she'd go around and give them out to everybody. And on this plane ride down here, I'm making all these little white flags. So I got a whole bag for them, a whole bag full of them. If anybody wants one, just come and see me. But, you know, the honest thing is that God did for me. You know, God really did for me. And I'm grateful that I had nowhere to turn. You know, I'm grateful. I was really angry that I had nowhere to turn. But if I'd been able to lean on a person and make somebody make it okay for me, I wouldn't have had to go to God. And I also wouldn't know where my source is. And, you know, I'm sober today by the grace of God. And I'm not, I know that there are still plenty of really rotten things that could happen to me in life. But I know that there isn't anything that God can't get me through. And I know that because of what I've been through this last year. My sponsor that I had died in September. My son died in January. My mother-in-law died in June. My daughter, I lost a grandchild in July. And in October, another one of my children tried to commit suicide. And at the end of that was when I just felt like, whoo, man, you know, I'm done. Stick a fork in me, I'm done, you know. My daughter that tried to kill herself is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She had 6 months 2 days ago. And what she's getting is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, she's getting it from the women out there that I got it from. And God has given me the strength to let go of her and let her find her AA the same way I did. And, you know, I just feel like we have nothing to fear. We just have a huge amount of hope. And the promises are non-existent for me because they have happened. To me, a promise is something that I can hope for. And those promises, every single one of them has happened. I have learned a new way to be free and a new way to be happy. It's not the way I thought I was going to be happy. It's not the same kind of happiness. In fact, I found out I would probably have been happy for a long time and I just didn't know it. Which is a rotten trick, you know, because I was looking for the old stuff. But, you know, those promises have come true for me. And I'm sober today. I'm so happy to be sober today. And I'm free and I'm hopeful. And I'm really grateful for the opportunity that I've had with my children. And I'm really grateful for those 5 days that I had with my son. And I'm grateful that the people in AA have given that to me. And I'm really grateful for this opportunity to be here. Thank you for inviting me down here.